Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's lesson. I'm one of your hosts, Patsy Zarella, Master Patsy Zarella, and with me, as always, is my instructor and friend, Master Grant Miller, at the Pittsburgh Airport of all places. How are you, sir? Pittsburgh
Airport. Yes, I'm at the airport. I'm doing good. I'm doing good. Thank you. How are you doing?
Oh, fantastic! It's been a pretty hectic week. Lots of stuff going on. It seemed like every time we decided we were gonna pick a topic, something else popped up. And you know, it's insane. But I know we're a little pressed for time. You're gonna have a flight to catch here pretty quick, so I want to get right into it, if that's okay with you.
Sounds good.
Okay, the first topic on the agenda today, I really wanted to talk a little bit about what's going on down on our southern border with the way we decided we're going to start separating families. I got to be honest. I know we try really, really hard to be kind of open-minded and to kind of see both sides of the issue and look at it from a martial perspective. But I got to be honest with you. I can't find anything good or positive about what we're doing down on the border. I can't find any good positive reasoning. I'm even trying to make stuff up, and I can't do it. I can't find any reason to justify these actions.
Neither can I. Part, you know, I am. I strongly support proper legal access into the country. So, you know, when you come in illegally, you are taking things into your own hands, and you have to suffer the consequences. But, you know, when you have children involved, I cannot fathom being taken away from my son or daughter for 5 days. You know, I mean, if things were desperate enough that I had to go and like maybe, you know, go to Canada for work or whatever, and I took my children with me, and oh my gosh, if I got separated, if they took, I don't know what I would do. I'm having a hard time with this because it's just something that is just so contrary to everything. Why do you have to separate them for 4 or 5 days? Why?
Yeah, that's minimum. You know, it doesn't do anybody any good. And I have a hard time with what we're doing. I have a harder time with this bullshit explanation that we're giving, that the government is giving to us, and an even harder time with people who are supporting this behavior. You know, it just for a second, just imagine you as a parent, even with your kids at their age. You know, we're not talking, even if you imagine your kids at you know, both your kids are in college, you know, one's getting close to graduation, mine's starting college. Imagine being in a situation or an environment or have a life that is so desperate and terrifying that even if you know what the consequences could be about coming to a border and crossing a border illegally, you're still willing to take that chance because it's still, I don't want to say better, but your option is not very good. The option to stay home and stay where you are and do nothing is far worse than the prospect of something like this happening. You know, even with teenager or kids or kids in their young early, you know, that's scary enough. Now imagine these, you know, pre-kindergarten or kindergarten or elementary school age, and you know you made a journey to the border because you know it's not like these people are camped out, you know, 5 steps away from the border, and they're trying to just get around the wall. I mean, they have to make a trip, a long, scary journey to get to that border, and then figure out a way to get through. And they're scared, and they're hungry, and they're desperate. And because they see where we are, and they see our country, and they see everything that we proclaim as the greatest country in the world, and the benefits that that living here gives them, and the opportunities that they're given living here, you know, and the freedoms and the protections that we have and take for granted. And they see that contrast to the poor and the absolutely horrendous conditions that they're working, that they're living in. And then we do this, and they don't even get to see their kids anymore. I'm having a hard time sleeping and thinking about this stuff. I truly am.
Yeah, because you're right. You got you have people living in conditions that are hard, we can't even imagine. They're horrible, and they're doing everything they can just to get away from it. They're trying to protect their families. And you're right. The United States is a beacon of hope. You know, it's a land of opportunity. And then you say, well, they should come in legally. Well, how can they? You know, their own government is in pieces. They can't probably get a visa anyway. They'll be denied. And so what do they do? I mean, and you know, that in itself is a bad enough situation. But when you actually make it here after going through all that turmoil to be separated, I mean, you're adding oil to the fire. It's just making things worse. I don't know what the solution is. I don't know what to say. I don't know what we can do about this, but I do know that you can't separate the families. You just can't do that. I mean, yeah, that I just have a real issue with.
And it's not like it's a law. It's policy, right? And we keep hearing this garbage that it's the Democrats that passed this thing. It's the Democrats that did this. It's the Democrats who did that. Well, there's only two problems with this garbage that you're feeding us. Well, three problems, really. Problem number one is you honestly think we're all this freaking stupid that you're going to blame somebody else and we're all going to sit there and go, okay, well, it must be them. Number two, as they continue to state over and over and over again, it's policy, which means anybody could change that policy, right? You have a president who's willing to write an executive order to tell everybody that the sky is green for now on. He could change the policy by picking up the phone and telling his Justice Department and Homeland Security or whoever else, hey, we're not doing this anymore. He's refusing to do that. Instead, he's deciding to start blaming other people, which is kind of his MO anyhow. But he's constantly doing this. Sarah Sanders is constantly standing at a podium and telling everybody that, you know, black is white and white is black, whenever she could easily say, you know what, the president is just deciding not to change the policy. And, you know, so first you're insulting us, and then while you're doing this, you're tearing families apart, and we're supposed to support you and back you. And I don't understand how the hell this can even be. I don't even understand how this is an issue.
Yeah, I think the way to fix it is to proclaim that this policy was written by Barack Obama and go and change it like overnight. Obama, he's got to change. But yeah. And, you know, it kind of leads into another topic, which is something that, I mean, we've had some celebrities, but it's been a long, long problem. And that is mental health. You know, what is, you know, mental health is looked down upon. It's not even looked on as a disease. It's looked on like a character failure. And, you know, when we see like celebrities, like people that you see on TV, you think they got it all together. And then they end up, you know, doing horrific things like hanging themselves in bathrooms. And, you know, and it's like, well, okay, he wasn't all together. He was sick. And, you know, and it's like, well, nobody gives any credence to that. And, you know, I that mental health to me is just as bad as like Zika virus or any type of illness. It's got to be treated as such. And I don't, and it's a shame that it takes, you know, basically two white celebrities to die for it to become to the forefront. But, you know, it is now. So I think that I would like to see a lot more being talked about and done about it.
You know, I had a student who probably would have stayed as a student if he didn't grow up and end up going to college and, you know, having to move away, whose father committed suicide. He hung himself. And the student was very, very young whenever this happened. In fact, whenever my son started in martial arts, he was going to school. He was going to class with this kid. And you know, you think about the pain and the mental state that somebody has to be in order to get to that point where they think that death is the best way out. You know, is the lesser of the two evils. You know, figuring, well, you know, at least the pain will be over, or you know.
Well, yeah. I mean, I had a student too who, you know, world champion, wonderful. You know, just a great person. Apparently, he was suffering, and you know, he was gone. He went to college for 2 years, and you know, and then when he was back one summer, he just threw himself in front of a train. And you know, you think about what is going on. To me, it's not. This is not something that comes onto you suddenly. For the most part, I think it's a very gradual process. I think it's something that builds up and until finally it's you at the breaking point. But it was so tragic when it happened. Now, you know, I hadn't seen him for like 2 years or 3 years while he was at school. But you think about, well, you know, within the martial arts, we try to instill confidence and we try to instill positive values that for people to have inside themselves. To know that they're valued, that they're worth, you know, their lives are meaningful and worthwhile, and they can contribute. And you know, when somebody turns around and then kills himself, well, something's broken. And it's like one of those things that it's like, what? Why? I still, to this day, I still can't understand why he did that.
And I guess the question that kind of comes to mind, you know, especially from my point of view, is as instructors, you know, how do we handle these things? How do we handle, you know, your student who did this to himself? You know, how do you handle if he would have known that he had this issue, and how do you handle a student whose family member, you know, his father did this? You know, how do you handle something like this? It's tough. It's really, really hard.
You know, I get a lot of students that come in that have, so you know, several handicaps of one form or the other, mental, and there's so many different reasons, so many different students. I always found that, you know, martial arts has always given them a good path and a good way to walk and lead their lives. Takes time, but it does work.
It's I guess one of the benefits to what we practice. It is, you know, we don't have the answers for everything, but we are able to establish good, strong, positive foundations that can be built on either by, you know, the people on your floor, or you know, their families, their parents, their siblings. You know, somebody can kind of grab onto what you're doing, and even if they're not doing it, you know, directly, you know, you kind of build this foundation, and maybe you're doing it in the background, and just by its very nature, you're kind of reinforcing the good and positive things that the other folks in these kids' lives are trying to do for them. You know, at least, you know, you have to try, you know, It's very difficult whenever you don't know, you know, what that this student had any indication that you had no idea that they were even contemplating doing something like this.
Yeah, it's really, it's even depressing to talk about.
But it is. But you know, it's a serious issue that I don't think it gets talked about enough.
Yeah. Jeez. So. You know, I look at, you know, when we train, I and when we talk about like the student creeds that are out there, like, you know, seek perfection of character, be faithful, endeavor, to person, you know, to, those are great things that are, if you take them to heart, are things you could absolutely build your life around and just follow. And, you know, because if you seek perfection of character, then it's hard to think suicidal thoughts. If you are endeavoring always to, you know, move forward, and, you know, it stops mental health issues. When you look at, you know, some of the things that are like, I will always seek the positive in other people, then you know, you're committing yourself to looking at good things in people, which again goes back and affects you. When you smile, when you force yourself to smile, even when you're not feeling like you want to smile, but you force yourself to, and not in an insincere way, but in a sincere way, where you really say, hey, you know what, I'm going to be happy, I'm going to smile, I'm going to make this other person feel happy, make this other person feel good about themselves, that, hey, I see them, and I'm talking to them, and I want to be with them, you know, because that's what type of person they are. So, and there is studies that show that when you do those type of things, it makes your brain go from thinking negative thoughts to thinking positive things about yourself. And it actually counteracts those negative feelings that you can get with suicidal thoughts.
It's amazing how, you know, caring for
it. Amazing what the old timers knew.
I'm sorry?
So it's amazing what the old timers knew.
Yeah, it is. You know?
They wrote those things because they knew. If you do these things, you stop from degenerating. They knew that. And they still speak to us if we would listen. You know, it's a lot of value to be had. Things I think are really needed today too, without question.
It's amazing how thinking of others actually benefits you, isn't it? In so many different ways.
And talking about the old timers, why don't we talk a little bit about the secret origins of Aikido?
You're just one segue after another here, aren't you?
Yeah, I thought it was that all planned. I had it all mapped out. I'm just making it up as I go. But you know,
we definitely are pressed for time today. So please continue, sir.
Okay, so when we last talked, we talked about Che Yong Sol, who was taken to Japan when he was young. He trained in some form or another with the samurai Sokaku Takeda, whether he just went to seminars or whether he was actually a manservant and actually trained with him and got a training certificate. Well, nobody will ever know the truth of what happened, but what is known is that he came to Korea a very proficient, very deadly, and very knowledgeable martial artist. And as we talked last time, I doubt that stuff you can pick up going to a couple seminars. I believe he was trained in one way or the other. And then we can see it, you can see it in the way he dismantled people, number one, but also in the students that he taught. And you know, there was a number of students. So when he first went and was given, after that the big fight in the yard outside the brewery, when the son of the owner, who's a judo black belt, brought him in and went a couple rounds with him and said, holy cow, you're amazing. And, you know, set up a dojang for him, and they brought students in. And, you know, that to me shows, number one, this guy was the real deal. He knew exactly what he was doing. And can you hear me okay?
Yep. Yeah, you're still good.
And then the students that he had. And so we look at some of those students, and there's a lot of them. A lot of his students that we'll go over and talk about, but there's one that I want to pick out first, and that would be who's titled Dojinim, Jihan Jay or Han Jay Ji. Jihan Jay was probably one of the most influential practitioners of the art of Che Yong Sol. He was one of the first to open the school. Che Yong Sol, when Jihan Jay went up to him and said, hey, I want to open up a school, Che Yong Sol turned around to the other students and said, listen to him. He's going to go open a school. What are you lot doing? So, you know, he had a full support of Che Yong Sol. And, you know, Jihan Jay And we're going to talk about, maybe not today, but we're going to talk about some of the other components that Jihan Jin brought to the table that kind of made the current art of Hapkido that we know it. But just looking at him with from Chaeyoung Seol's perspective, you know, here is one of his number one students. And we know he was number one because we see it in the pictures. He was always seated next to or slightly one person away from Chaeyoung Seol in almost all the pictures that you see. You know, his skills were exemplary. You know, when he was featured in the movie with Bruce Lee, Game of Death, you know, Bruce Lee made a comment that Jihan Jay was probably the most deadliest martial artist he's ever met in the world. Well, that's saying something, because by that time, Bruce Lee's been around, right? And so he's seen a lot of different people. For him to make a comment like that, that's pretty, that means something. And you know, and you can see, like, okay, yeah, it's a movie. And so when you watch it, you got to suspend your disbelief and, right. But you can see the skills that are there. And quite frankly, I really don't think Bruce Lee would have been able to hang with Jihan Jay in a real match. And I don't. I think Bruce Lee might have gotten a fast kick in or a fast strike. And I think Jihan Jay would have tore his arm off.
it's high praise indeed coming from, but even in the movie, you know, you watch it, you can definitely see the skill and the movement and the knowledge that is Jihan Jay's. You can, if you can't, you really don't know what you're looking at.
And in the movie, Jihan Jay struck a pose which was very classic, where he raised his one hand up over his arm, and that was the Kumgong warrior stance, which is a very traditional stance, and then you could do so much from it. Now, during the movie, they didn't really show. Well, of course, it was a martial arts movie for the masses, so not a martial arts movie for martial artists. Because had it been that, then we would have seen a lot more of what you can do from that technique. But because as you and I have trained, there's a lot that you, I mean, there's so much you can do from there. But getting back to the point of Jihan Jay really being one of the forefront number one students of Chaeyoung Seol and really bringing the world to Hapkido. Now, we talked about last time that Chaeyoung Seol had learned the art of Daitoryu Aikijutsu, which is the art that Takeda taught. Which was one of his family, it was just his family's art that passed down from generation to generation. And that's what Chaeyoung Seol learned. And on the old pictures that I see of the school of Chaeyoung Seol, on the bottom in Chinese, it's always written, Daitoryu Aikijutsu. And then that's he knew, even though he might have been illiterate, you still learn the basic characters. And it was really hard, I think, for people to understand that. They say, well, he's illiterate. He doesn't know how to write. He doesn't know what that means. Not true. You know, we use emojis a lot. And emojis are similar in concept to Chinese characters. There are going to be emojis that you're going to know, even if you can't read a string of emojis and understand what they mean. There are going to be emojis that you know, like the smiley face, you know, is happy. Even though it might be included in a string, you won't know what that string meant. You would know that. And so, words like titles, especially school names, Jay also would definitely know the characters for Daitoryu Aikijutsu. That would be something that he would absolutely know. And that it was on these pictures, not only him, but everybody else, and that it was on these pictures, to me, states that that's what they were teaching back then. And when we look at who crafted the name Hapkido, who actually developed it? Well, I think there's two arguments there. I think there's one, who crafted the name, and then number two, who crafted the art that we know today as Hapkido. And I think those are two different discussions because the name in itself is a wonderful topic to go on, basically because of the use of the same characters that Aikido uses, how that once that was discovered, how it was changed, and whatnot. So we could go talk about that maybe in the next one, but yeah, those are some of my comments and thoughts about the early days of our origins of the art.
So it's nice to see, and I mean this in many fronts. It's nice to see, first of all, the direct lineage from, you know, for me, you know, from my training, and I can see a direct lineage from, you know, from my down to my students and then up, you know, to you and above, and how we have a direct line to the origins. And that to me, it doesn't mean a whole lot, you know, out in the parking lot at 2 a.m., but it means a lot to the person who's practicing it, to at least know that what you're practicing, what you're teaching, and you know, how big a part of your life it becomes, you know, just how straight up and legitimate it is. You know, it does a lot. It says a lot about the characters of the people who are practicing. To me, it's a very big deal. You know, like I said, it's not going to mean a whole lot if I ever have to use it, or, you know, when I've had to use it, but it means a lot to me whenever I'm teaching.
Yeah, and, you know, that kind of leads into the topic about, you know, do we keep, like do we train in martial arts to perfectly replicate what the masters before us did? Or do martial arts grow and evolve and change with the times? And what I like about the art of Hapkido is that it does not shirk away from changing with the times. When, you know, it definitely morphs and, you know, changes with the styles and with the techniques and things that are needed for today that are different from when, you know, Chae Yong Sol first ventured back onto the shores of Korea. We see that like in classical karate and classical martial arts, we'll see big fight between traditionalists and people who want to take more progressive routes. And they'll say, like, well, hey, you got to do your Pinon 5 kata this way or you're out of here, right? And there's people who say, hey, I'm going to do Pinon kata the way that it was originally done, but then I'm going to take a look at some of those moves and I'm going to incorporate them into maybe how to disarm a gun or, you know, making it a little bit more modernized and taking the techniques that are hidden in the katas and working with them instead of just doing rote memorization. I think that there's always like a middle happy ground. I think one of the best ways to approach it is first memorize and practice exactly the way the masters did, because that builds a solid foundation. You can't go wrong with that. You're going to build a solid foundation. And then from there, now branch out and start to explore. Take what you've learned and now work with it. Put it into scenarios. See if it fails. See if it works. You know, it might fail. There's techniques in Hapkido that will absolutely fail today, you know, in modern times. You know what I'm talking about. there's some things that just will not, are just not applicable. But are they still good to learn? Absolutely they're good to learn. Because that's part of the, number one, it's part of the art. But number two, it builds your foundation that you maybe not use it exactly that same way, but you can morph it and change it slightly to make it effective.
Right, and you know, I tell students all the time. In fact, I did it last night down on your floor last night. I did it. I was instructing on the cross-eyed basic eight, and I repeatedly said, okay, you know, here's, you know, technique number one, here's technique number two, here's how you do it. And then I said, here's how I do it. And I was, eventually, you're going to figure out how you do it, but this is how you're going to learn it. You know, because you have to have that good, solid foundation, you know, in order to know that eventually you're going to make the art your own, which is ultimately what you want to do. But if in the process of making that art your own, you're learning it and developing it in a way that is just not correct because of things such as balance or proper movement or good footwork, that you're going to carry that flaw with you through everything you learn in that technique and in the art for as long as you practice it. And whenever you become the person who's doing the instructing or the person who the instructors are relying on to help instruct, you're going to pass that flaw on. And you know, you can't do that. It's one thing to practice it in a way that fits your body type and your movement and your balance and your age and everything that goes along with it. But at the same time, you have to be very conscious of the traditional proper way of doing the technique.
So yes, I personally, I am a huge fan of and a practitioner at the traditional method. I want to learn Aikido the traditional way. I want to know how it was done by, you know, Che Yong Sol, by Jian Jie. I want to know exactly how they did it. The same thing with karate. You know, I want to practice it exactly the way Master Funakoshi did it, why, you know, Kanazawa. Oh, but then on the same token, you know, you practice, but then it becomes yours. It's interesting that when you see, like when a student starts and they don't know anything, it's really important that you teach a solid foundation and not go off center too much, because they aren't ready for that. They need to learn the basics, right? And all during that time, it's okay to show them, like, here's how we would do it in the street, for example. Let's say somebody came out there with a big roundhouse. No, somebody's coming out with a big haymaker. How would I use this, right? It's okay to show them that, but say, look, we're not ready yet to start practicing this. We need to work on it the way that, you know, it was originally intended to be learned. And then after they get their foundations down, then start opening up. And it's wonderful to see how students' eyes just open up when they say, holy cow, you can do that? And it's like, yeah. And then it's also interesting to see how different people work different ways. You know, you get some people very fluid, very, you know, they can, the circularity, weight balance, weight underside, shifting, and then they just do one. And then you got other people who are, you know, just more about, like, none of these are wrong. I'm just saying others were very linear and, you know, can execute it just as powerfully in that manner. And I think that's really cool to see, you know, to experience that way, the differences. But it all stems back to learning it right, learning the foundations right, so that you could then take it and become your own.
Yeah, and it's amazing how much I tell folks, look, you may not understand why I'm teaching it to you this way. And you may not even agree with how I'm telling you or how I'm showing you. Or, you know, you think right. It's easier this way or it's more effective another way. And you know, I understand that from your point of view, you may be correct. But I'm not showing you or teaching you a technique so you know a technique. I'm teaching you a technique so you learn all of the little subtle intimate details that go into that technique, because you will use those and you will need that foundation in order to do other things and to do things properly.
Right. And back in the old days, it used to be that you would go to the dojo, you would pay your, you know, $50, and you would learn one technique. That day is you would learn one technique. Can you imagine spending an entire day on one technique?
And it's not just an hour, it's an entire day.
It's an entire day. What are you going to do? How can you do a Z-lock all day long? You know, it's not. They would train it probably 2-3 hours, okay, until they really got it down, and then they would start to experiment with it and use it in practical situations. And that's how you get really good.
And that's probably the proper way to teach and to learn it. But
$50 a technique.
Yeah, well,
that's a little cheap, I think.
you think about it. My last testing, my guys were showing about 130 techniques. So, you know, $50 a shot, I could probably quit a job or two. You know, it's funny.
Yeah.
we do our best, you know, but the students have to express it and make it their own, but at the same time, they have to learn the proper ways of doing this, or everything goes to pot if you don't. So it's a pretty good balancing act that we have to.
All right, now I got a major question for you.
All right,
your man, Messi, missing a PK.
You believe that?
What's going on with that? Iceland, Argentina, Messi.
I'll be honest with you. I cried. I really did. I just
did he go? I didn't get a chance to see it because I'm in the airport. Did he go wide right or wide left or?
Oh no, he was right on target. The goaltender made a great stop.
Oh, the goaltender blocked it. I heard on the news that he missed.
Well, it's a miss, but yeah.
Okay, well, the goaltender saves it. Well, what can you do?
The entire side did not play very well, which is kind of heartbreaking. Whenever you figure it's not like you didn't know who your opponent was going to be until you stepped on the pitch, and you know, the club season's basically been over for a couple of weeks now. You know, so they had all the time in the world to prepare for Iceland. And speaking of linear, you know, Iceland is a linear side, and the things that have plagued Argentina for this last World Cup cycle really showed up in spades. They're on paper, they are an amazing assembly of talented players, arguably the most talented side in the World Cup, player for player. And you have the greatest of all time on your side. So you
got better than Spain, player for player, better than Spain.
Yeah, I would argue.
España? No way.
I would
Spain
argue.
Spain is the best player for player. Pound for pound, Spain has got the best team.
Okay, so you can disagree. That's fine. But
I think it's going to be Germany, Spain.
After watching Spain give a game to Portugal, and I understand that Portugal was the defending European champions. I get that. Spain went from down 1-0 to tie it to down 2-1 to actually take the lead 3-2, and then just was absolutely horrible the last 8 to 10 minutes of the match, and ended up giving up a free kick to Ronaldo to tie, and it was Piqué that fouled him. If anybody knows what Ronaldo is going to do whenever he gets the ball around the 18, it's Piqué. I mean, they play the biggest game in the world every year, and you know what this guy's going to do. You've played against him how many times, and you still do this boneheaded play. You know, anyhow, you know, you saw.
I'm going to have to get going. My plane is there calling me.
Oh, you better get going.
So, before I go, question of the week: who would win, Donald Trump or Kim Jong-un?
Oh, geez. Same rules as last time, right? In their prime.
Same ages.
Same age. Let's see. Trump did have the military school experience, but I'm going to take a shot in the dark and say he really didn't pay a whole hell of a lot of attention to the training that he received. So I'll give it to Kim, just because knowing his family history, if there was any kind of martial arts in his family, that definitely would have been handed down to him, and he would have been expected to do very well in it. So I'll give it to him.
All right. Well, I'm going to go to the other side, because I don't think either of them have any training, and I think what it's going to boil down to is just going to be a big fisticuff, bunch of haymakers being thrown, and usually when it's a bunch of haymakers being thrown, the bigger guy wins. So I'm going to go with President Donald Trump on that one.
There you go. Well, before you go, just a quick note, I wanted to tell you and everybody who is listening or will listen, I wanted to wish everybody a very happy Father's Day tomorrow. I hope people understand what a blessing it is to be a father, and don't take it for granted. So to you, sir, happy Father's Day.
Well, thank you. And I want to wish everybody a happy Father's Day as well. It's a great holiday, and something that
I wanted to make sure everybody knows, and happy Father's Day to you.
Oh, thank you, sir. Before we go, real quick, to everybody, please click on that like button and click on the bell so you know whenever we're on. Also, our podcast is now an MP3 podcast, an audio podcast. There's a very good chance we're going to be on iTunes very soon. We are already on Stitcher and a couple others. If you look for us on just about any podcasting website or app there is, I'm pretty sure you're going to find us by now. But we're hoping to get on iTunes. That's the big one. So until then, sir, I will talk to you sometime during the week, and then we'll get together again next week and see what other mayhem we can discuss and complain about.
Yes, perfect. I won't be traveling next week, so we'll have more time, and I would really dive into some of these issues that we've been talking about. So, all right. Thank you, sir. Talk to you soon.
Thank you, sir. See you. And goodbye to everybody. Bye-bye.